With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Listen, we need to talk. You've been hearing me make the case for why you should support Canada Land. And I know that for, like, I don't know, maybe a lot of you, the case makes sense. The fact that you're not going to have news, you're not going to have independent media, you're not going to have podcasts if you don't pay for them. I know that you get that. And yet there's something that is like standing in the way of you going to patreon.com/CanadaLand and actually hitting the button and supporting us. And I can't act like I don't know what that thing is. It's me. I get it. I understand. I know that even to people who choose to spend time with me listening to this podcast, the idea of sending me money is a tough one because of my personality. And I don't think there's anybody on the planet who can commiserate with you about that more than me. I can't turn it off. It's not, I don't have the option, you know, like you do, of just listening to a different podcast. This is a 24/7 thing. And it's sort of become my job to be this person. And, you know, I make no apologies because if you have this personality and this propensity to irritate people, why not put it towards something worthwhile? I feel like I found my calling. I know that I have, but it's a lot. It can be a lot. What I need to tell you right now is that that's not a good reason to not support Canada Land. I don't get that money. That money is going to the company, and the first place it's going to go is to raises for our staff, which we still need quite a bit of support if we're going to get those raises for everybody here, and more support and resources and benefits for them. And then we move on to funding our next big journalistic project. We make every dollar we get go so far. And the Patreon money that we get in, that is for the functioning of Canada Land as a journalistic enterprise. So in summary, I feel you about the Jesse issue. Please support us anyhow. Patreon.com/CanadaLand. Thank you. John Ronson was terribly upset with me after this interview. When I say thank you to him near the end, you'll hear him reply, "It's my pleasure." But as soon as we stopped recording, he let me know that it was anything but. He told me that I had ruined his morning. I didn't mean to. I like John Ronson. Quite a bit, actually. He's one of my favorite essayists, and I've admired his radio stories on This American Life for years. He's the author of a lot of books you might have heard of, The Men Who Stare at Goats, Them, Adventures with Extremists, and The Psychopath Test. I don't always agree with him, which I saw as a good thing. Good reason to have a conversation with him. When we invited him onto the show, we told him that we wanted to talk about his most recent podcasts, which are all about the porn industry and some of the people within it, surprising number of whom are Canadian. And in the most recent of those podcasts, there's a theme that I really wanted to discuss with him, which is his take on public shaming through social media. Generally speaking, he's against it. And he was early to the issue, writing a book called So You've Been Publicly Shamed in 2015. His promotion of that book took the form of an impassioned public plea for decency and humanity. It became his cause, his campaign. Here are some bits from his TED Talk of that year.
These days, the hunt is on for people's shameful secrets. You can lead a good ethical life, but some bad phraseology in a tweet can overwhelm it all, become a clue to your secret inner evil. And I began to feel weird and empty when there wasn't a powerful person who had misused their privilege that we could get. A day without a shaming began to feel like a day picking fingernails and treading water. The great thing about social media was how it gave a voice to voiceless people, but we're now creating a surveillance society where the smartest way to survive is to go back to being voiceless. Let's not do that. Thank you.
As you heard, John Ronson told a story in that talk about public shaming that began with Twitter empowering the voiceless, but then devolving into a dangerous tool of an amoral mob, choosing ever more undeserving targets for horrific public attacks. But he said all of those things before the Me Too movement. It seemed to me that things had moved in exactly the opposite direction Ronson feared it would. Instead of shaming finding increasingly undeserving targets, the practice called out the previously untouchable and the most deserving of ostracization. I never imagined that John Ronson was against Me Too, but I wondered if it had changed his early views. His most recent podcast suggested to me that maybe it had. The Last Days of August is about the suicide of the Canadian-born porn performer August Ames, and content warning, this episode will deal with the topic of suicide. And the fact that she died by suicide initially appears to be the result of public shaming on Twitter. But as Ronson examines and investigates it, the truth is revealed to be much more complicated. It turns into a murder mystery, and then into something else entirely. Was this Ronson exploring his evolving thoughts on public shaming through a narrative podcast? I tell you all of this now because it's important to me that you know, and that he knows, if he happens to be listening to this, what kind of interview I had in mind. It's a very different one than the one that you're about to hear. We recorded this in his Toronto hotel room, the morning after he performed at the Hot Docs Podcast Festival. Before we began, he told us that he was exhausted from the night before. After we finished, he told us that he had done 100 interviews, and no one else had so badly misunderstood his work. He also said that perhaps he would later be angry with himself for being so grumpy. On our way out, we tried to discuss with him how upset he still seemed. We wanted to recognize that he seemed to feel like we had somehow ambushed him. He said, yes. Yes, that's what this was, an ambush. We apologized that he felt ambushed. And then he said, he never said that. He never said he was ambushed. We were the ones who introduced that word, which was true. I still don't really understand what happened in this interview. I'm open to the idea that I misunderstood or even misrepresented his ideas the way that he feels that I did. But I also wonder if perhaps I raised contradictions in his writing that he hasn't fully resolved yet, and he reacted to that. I guess you can make up your own mind. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Brina Lichty, Alexander Scott Wilson, Jonathan Cornelson, Katie Harmer, Chris Hagerman, Mike Brown, Jamie Olson, and Charlie Martel.
I'm Charlie Martel, an attorney in San Francisco, California. I'm interested in what goes on in Canada because about half of my family and half of my wife's family emigrated from Canada a couple of generations ago, and our daughter is in her second year of university in Canada. I support Canada Land in its Spawn podcasts because it adds a lot of texture to the coverage of Canada that we get in the States. It helps fill in some of the gaps for me. Thanks and keep up the good work.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hi, John.
Hello.
Here we are in Canada, which you've exposed as a global capital in the pornography industry.
Yeah, you know, the story that I did last night on stage, every single one of the main people in the story is Canadian. Everyone.
Are you surprised to not see people fornicating in the hallways of this hotel? Is this
Well, I don't think of Canadians as sexual. So it's more of a surprise to see that they get into porn.
Why did we need a Welshman to tell us that we are a global capital of the pornography industry?
Well, I had no conception of Canada's link to porn, but it's quite remarkable. So in my story, I told two stories last night. The first half was about the proliferation of Pornhub and how that's affected the lives of porn people. And Pornhub's Canadian, it's in from Montreal. Mm-hmm. And then in the second half of the story, I tell a story about a kind of pretty unconnected story of a porn star who took her life. And she and her best friend and her husband are all Canadian. And her best friend is also a porn star. And then the porn director we were embedded with for a year or two when I was making The Butterfly Effect is Canadian. It's just all, maybe, I don't know. What I mean, you should tell me. I have no explanation.
I'm not sure myself. I mean, I was aware when I lived in Montreal that there was a Quebecois porn industry, that there was a French-Canadian porn industry. But all the people who you have and subjects are not from that world. And then the Mind Geek thing is not really from that world either. So it seems like it's sort of a discrete...
Mm. But you know, MindGeek's Canadian.
That's what I'm saying, is that they are, the things that you look at are Canadian pornography things, but they're not of that French-Canadian pornography world. They're of this bland, desexualized.
Yes, yeah. I don't know anything about French-Canadian pornography world. It sounds much more ooh-la-la.
So the Canadianness of all this is one of the few things that's unexplored in your work on porn. Do you have any conclusions or any observations about
climate?
It?
You know, I think the honest answer is probably just knowing why August Ames moved from Canada to Los Angeles and why Mike Quasar did and so on. I just think, you know, maybe they felt about LA the same way that I felt about LA growing up in faraway Cardiff, as this sort of mysterious, exciting, you know, mm-hmm. good climate place. Maybe it's just, it's a place where people from the provinces want to go because it seems so mysterious and exciting.
Just your usual small town people.
Yeah, I'm sorry
attracted
I'm sorry to be disappointing, but I think so. I mean, that's why August moved. I'm sure it's why Mike Quasar moved. Mm-hmm. If I ever moved to LA, it would be the reason why I'd move. The problem with LA, though, is that it's a very isolating place. This is the conclusion that I came to in the end. You know, the LA nightmare is, you know, you go there trying to make it And then you rent some, you know, apartment or house, depending on what you can afford, in some suburb, you know, Los Feliz or Hancock Park, and you just never leave your house because there's no incentive. There's no walking culture.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the entertainment industry in Los Angeles is just waiting. You just wait with very nice interior design.
And excellent weather.
Yeah, and excellent weather.
But for people who are used to community, that can be really destructive.
And also, you know, some people are prone to isolation. It's a really bad habit. And LA, I think, is a really terrible place if you're that.
I kept thinking as I listened to The Last Days of August about the similarities between pornography and journalism.
Ooh.
Your response suggests that was not an intentional parallel.
Well, it depends where you're going with it. It might be, and I just haven't caught up yet.
Okay. Pornographers and journalists both display very personal things about our subjects for the enjoyment of our audiences.
Well, first-person journalists do, not reporters. So you're talking about pornography and people like David Sedaris.
I'm talking about the work that you do.
Yeah.
And you're turning the camera or your microphone on a subject and, you know.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the show I did last night, I tell the story about sort of the impact that doing The Last Days of August had on me. And that was really personal. And I'm usually never that personal, but it sort of felt appropriate to do that in that particular story, because the parallels of, like, you know, the impact it had on me weren't dissimilar to some of the people in the story.
Yeah, it's not the first time for you. In fact, the way that I kind of was introduced to you was you kind of popped out from This American Life to me as a novel voice, in that you were the first. I'm used to this voice of I'm your sensitive man who's taking you through this story, and I'm just an objective. And you were the first person to draw into question, can I trust my narrator? Is this somebody whose account of things is not self-interested? And you played with that in a really novel way. So you say that you know, I think you're used to turning things on yourself as well. So you can see it both as the pornographer who's filming someone, and also somebody who is mining your own personal, you're exposing things that are personal about yourself. What was the personal reaction you had to covering these things?
Well, and can I say, I think you're right. I think that's true. It sounds a bit, I guess, glib. And also it's a bit weird. It's a bit embarrassing because, okay, so like, it's now November, but back in January, I had a little sort of 2-week, I'm trying to think of the best. I was diagnosed with something called adjustment disorder, which I've got to say is the most boring sounding mental disorder. It sounds like something that accountants should get. It's kind of annoying that, you know, everyone wants a diagnosis. So finally, when you get one, it's such a shitty sounding one.
You would have preferred psychopath?
Well, no, I'm not going to go that far, but I don't know, something a bit better than adjustment disorder.
Yeah, fair.
So, and it was really it was a bunch of things, but part of it was like having to grapple with the ethical implications of telling The Last Days of August.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, what do we do about August's husband, Kevin?
Yeah.
Who was a grieving husband, but at the same time, people kept telling us, you know, everything from crazy conspiracies down to much more realistic, you know, bore some responsibility. So what do you do with that? So the impact of that. It's funny, you know, when I was younger, if I was still 30, I don't think I'd have sweated it so much. But I think now I'm in my latter years.
Yeah.
I think just the sort of ethical implications of that just weighed so heavily on me. Kevin's reputation was in my hands, and he'd just lost his wife. I mean, Jesus. And this was the story that we found ourselves in. And anyway, it all sort of caved in on me. Just for a couple of weeks. And I wouldn't normally sort of talk about that kind of thing, except for a few things. First, I'm forever chronicling other people's mental health issues, so it would have been a bit hypocritical not to have chronicled my own. Mm-hmm. And two, it felt relevant to the story because it's all about, like, husbands and wives and how my wife dealt with me when I got sick and, you know, and how people deal with each other when, you know, things are bad. And it's also to do with isolation. I just felt there was lots of parallels between this like little mini thing that happened to me in January and what was happening in August's life. And the fact that it came for me reporting on the story, it just felt relevant to tell the story.
I want to be explicit about this for people who haven't heard your podcast yet, and they should. But this was a situation where it was kind of familiar to listeners of true crime shows, at least at the beginning, where we are told a story, or there's an accepted version of the story where August killed herself after being bullied online. She tweeted something about not wanting to do a scene with a male porn actor who had done gay work, who had done crossover work, and then she had been publicly shamed for this, and then very shortly thereafter committed suicide.
The same, like a few hours later.
And very early in your telling of this, there's more to it. And everyone is saying, no, you got to look at the husband. And so you kick up this cloud of suspicion around, this is a murder mystery where we're going to find out whether or not this guy did it. And then you did something, I guess, to deal with. And it's interesting to hear now that this wasn't just an ethical dilemma you faced, but something that was actually like became a problem for your well-being. What did you say? You said
this isn't a murder mystery.
Yeah. I don't want this to be one of those shows that creates narrative tension by fueling the suspicion that someone might be a murderer, which is exactly what just happened at that moment. But then you diffuse it. But you don't want to take the stakes down of your own story.
Yeah.
So what you say is, so what I want to tell you is that while we uncover some extraordinary things, devastating mysteries will reveal themselves solved.
That was maybe a bit too much.
No, it worked wonderfully. But this will not turn out to be a murder mystery. So what you did there.
Yeah.
It was ethical. You could, because I've thought this when listening to other podcasts where they make you think, oh, the parents did it or the husband did it. I'm like, if this turns out not to be the murderer, fuck you guys.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, terrible. I mean, how could you live with yourself? I mean, and people do it all the time in like amateur true crime podcasts.
But what you did is itself a very clever narrative device, because what do you mean, John, that this isn't going to be a murder mystery? Like, are you saying he didn't kill her? Then why don't you just say that? What are these devastating mysteries that you're going to solve that are not murder mysteries? So you actually create this new question. Like, what does he mean? And it's a brilliant trick that I don't think anyone can ever do again. Like, did he or did he not do it is a trick that people have been using for hundreds of years, and they'll continue to do for hundreds of years. But you found one thing.
Yes.
And now it's burned.
It was quite a juggling act. Well, I mean, the main thing obviously was the ethics of it. Like, I couldn't have lived with myself if I was creating narrative tension out of Kevin.
And you were actually having difficulty living with yourself.
Yeah. I think the sort of lead up to my little mini thing had begun by the time I wrote that.
Yeah.
That voiceover. I mean, it got worse afterwards. That didn't like make me better, but it was like part of the...
If the anxiety was caused by the prospect of what you were doing to this guy, then why wouldn't that make it better?
To be honest, it's probably like, you know, it's if you... Well, okay. In OCD, which I don't really have, there's a thing called scrupulosity, which is excessive concern for moral issues. So if you're a kid in the American Bible Belt... and you have scrupulosity, you might become convinced that like Satan is living inside of you. But if you're a kid in like liberal Toronto and you have scrupulosity, it might manifest yourself with you sort of haunting yourself with the possibility that you might shout out something racist. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's my way of saying that maybe I was worrying a little bit too much about the story, but doing that disclaimer at the beginning of episode two, I didn't think, oh, well, that's okay now.
Right.
You know, I still had worries. I still had lots of worries.
Do you think that that's maybe reflective of the wider reality of your work? The work, I mean, we do the same kind of work of we are looking for people who have stories usually of trauma and tragedy.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep coming back to the pornography thing because there is an issue of consent and we try to find subjects who want to be spoken to, but the very act that they are performing their reality for an audience of the supposed intimacy, be it sex or be it some drama, changes how they present it, and then you become the conduit through which they do that.
Yes.
And they don't always get what they want from you.
No.
Nor should they necessarily, right? But
yeah, well, then you've got like whole questions about like journalism. Is it like... But of course, if there was no journalism, then we'd all be fucked. So there has to be journalism. There has to be, you know, people have to go in and be critical, you know, look at other people with a critical eye.
Well, that's the other parallel with pornography, is that everybody uses journalism, but people are kind of disgusted by us for doing it.
Yeah, when I was growing up, there was this show in Britain called Brookside, which was like, it was set in Liverpool. It was like a, you know, like a soap opera. And every time there was a journalist, like all the characters, the books are like, a bloody journalist, bloody journalist. And yeah, it made everybody hate journalists.
Yeah.
People hate us.
Something that links this most recent podcast of yours to your earlier work is that it begins with a public shaming. Mm. And in your book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I think you take a pretty dim view on the people who pile in, the call-out culture, whatnot. Yeah. But there's a bit of a more nuanced story that is revealed in this podcast, where the idea that everybody was upset with August for saying this thing about not wanting to work with this male actor, and then she killed herself. And it turns out to be much, much more complicated than that. Mm. And I wonder if that reveals some sort of an evolution of your feeling about call-out culture itself and public shaming.
Not really, because I think one of the things I write about in So You've Been Publicly Shamed is, you know, we're judging people on a sliver of evidence, on the, you know, the tiniest amount of evidence. Justine Sacco, this woman that nobody's ever heard of, tweets, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. So everybody, you know, while she's asleep on a plane, everybody in the world becomes a Miss Marple, deciding, you know, that they know everything about this woman. Like they, mm-hmm. they've drawn an entire world about who this woman is from that one tweet, which turned out to be incorrect. She was trying to be like, I mean, it wasn't a great tweet, but...
What was incorrect?
She wasn't a racist. She was doing a kind of Randy Newman, South Park type mockery of her own privilege.
Right.
So it was the opposite, like her tweet. I mean, I'm not defending the tweet. It was a terribly worded tweet, but its meaning was the opposite of what everybody decided that it was. So one of the themes, I think, of So You've Been Publicly Shamed is, you know, in actual courtrooms, we have sentencing hearings. You know, when somebody's been convicted, then other people come along and say, well, you ought to know this about this person, you ought to know that about this person. Here we are on social media trying to better the justice system because we think it's flawed. And of course it is flawed, but we're throwing out one of the most important parts of it, which is context. So the thing about August is that, you know, nobody knew anything that was going on in her life when she tweeted, you know, those homophobic tweets. And the fact is, as the program shows, extraordinary things were happening in her life.
I think that that's an important thing for people to remember now more than ever, is that whatever has got you upset online or whatever comment somebody made, they have their own struggle and there's a context that you may not be aware of. Mm. But I also feel like, and you wrote So You've Been Publicly Shamed before the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. I do feel like your work has a lot of sympathy for so-called extreme people, and writing should humanize people, but you humanize Alex Jones, whose own work in the public conversation has been incredibly harmful to the Sandy Hook survivors, right? Mm. You and before that,
I would say that every story I did about Alex Jones, except for the last one, was before Sandy Hook, was before he was doing that kind of thing.
Yes.
And the story that I did subsequent to Sandy Hook is much more critical.
It's much more damning, and yet it also humanizes him, which is fine because he's a human being. But you have, I think, kind of a predilection or an interest in this person is a caricature of an evil person. You did the same thing with Omar Bakri Muhammad, who was Osama bin Laden's man in London and was involved in calling for kidnappings and murders and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you let him off the hook, but you do show him as kind of this teddy bear as well. Mm. It seems like that's an area of interest of yours. And then when people are calling somebody out, I feel like you're kind of disgusted by the moral righteousness of that.
Yeah, but I mean, these aren't Me Too stories. These are private individuals getting disproportionately shamed by, you know, millions of people.
For their public comments.
By all these disparate groups who, you know, unite to frenziedly attack somebody who's a private individual nobody knows anything about for a misconstrued joke.
It wasn't misconstrued.
Go on.
I mean, she was both citing her own privilege. But simultaneously, she was extending and playing on a stereotype of Africa as a diseased, AIDS-ridden hellhole, just as the tweets that were upset with August, most of them were simply people saying, this is a very homophobic tweet.
Yeah.
Like, if you had said, my agent wants me to go have sex with a black porn actor and this isn't fair, or, you know, I consider Jewish porn actors to be dirty and I don't want to do that, I think that we wouldn't have had any hesitation to say, like, that is an absolutely discriminatory, bigoted tweet.
But can you show me where I'm disagreeing with that? Because
I guess it seems like you're critical of the people, like, simply saying you shouldn't be saying that because they don't know about her private life and they don't know about her personal struggle.
Can you show me where I'm critical of the people who called out her homophobic tweets?
In this conversation, you were talking about how people in a frenzy
pile on. No, I was talking about Justine Sacco there.
Okay, okay.
She was making fun of her own bubble of privilege. She was mocking her own ignorance.
Yeah, I mean, look.
Which is a liberal joke.
Finding a place between a defense of satire.
And that's not me too. That's something completely different. And if you put the two together, you're creating a tyrannical Stasi.
But isn't there an evolution? I mean, when Lenny Bruce went through every epithet he could think of and pointed at people in the audience and said the N-word to people in the audience, that was an incredible breakthrough in satire and in opening up a dialogue that was necessary at the time. Today, it would be very different.
Yeah, but if you put a misconstrued liberal joke together with Me Too, you're talking about a very minor transgression that you're trying to lump in with really serious bad shit. If you do that, then, you know, you're undermining. Well, for a start, you're undermining social justice, because what happened to Justine Sacco wasn't social justice.
What happened to her?
Well, she was fired.
Yeah.
She was in the wilderness for a year or maybe even more. You know, the impact on her mental health, my God.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, you know, people kill themselves, you know. So I can tell from your tone that you think that's, you know, that you think somebody just sort of deserves that for or maybe I'm overestimating how you feel about that. But, you know, basically she, for a misconstrued liberal joke, for a liberal joke mocking her own privilege while she was asleep on a plane and completely oblivious to her destruction, 1.2 million people tweeted about how disgusting, including Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So, in fact, if you're defending the people who powered in on Justine Sacco, by the way, you're defending Donald Trump too, because he was one of those people. You're defending misogynists who called for her to be raped. You're defending, you know, people sending death threats to her. There's nobody in my book who transgressed in a serious way. That's not what the book's about. I'm, you know, of course, you know, because I'm a progressive, I'm entirely in favor of Me Too and Black Lives Matter. This is not a book about Me Too or Black Lives Matter.
Sure, but
and also, in the last days of August, I'm not even slightly criticizing the people who powered. You know, it's a complete misrepresentation.
Well, that was my initial point, I'm wondering if your take has evolved, because you actually start with this position that this public shaming might have been a murderous act, and you realize that reality is a lot more complicated. And then, in fact, the public shaming was one ingredient, but among many factors.
But even if I did think that the public shaming was a murderous act, even if I still felt that about August Ames, I was not criticizing the people who were rightly annoyed by her tweet. You know, you seem to be lumping a whole lot of nuanced shit into like one big blah.
I guess I'm curious about what I feel is a generalization on your part.
Go on.
Well, I've heard you say many times about this pile-on effect. And when people don't care about the human being behind it, we're both Jewish people, right? So before there was such a thing as social media, we had the Anti-Defamation League, which said, you know what, it's not good enough for people to just avoid saying kike. We are going to be hypersensitive snowflakes when people talk about globalists or communists or rootless cosmopolitans. We're going to look at the coded language of anti-Semitism. We're going to look at when people talk about the secret interests that are controlling the world. And we don't have the authority to lock you up or to shut you up, but we have our standards about how we're going to be talked about. And if you transgress those standards, there's an office that's going to say, that's anti-Semitic and you shouldn't be saying it. And all I see is that power has now been distributed to people who don't have an Anti-Defamation League. So why shouldn't somebody, and are they just becoming a member of a frenzied mob, say to a Justine Sacco, and I'm not defending the misogynists and the calls for her suicide. But if somebody said, you are, in your attempt, your fumbling attempt at satire, buttressing this idea of Africa as a diseased, AIDS-ridden hellhole, and you shouldn't be saying that, and that's the line that we're going to try to instill and publicly protect. Like, is there anything wrong with a good public shaming when people finally have the ability to call out the ways in which they're being maligned publicly?
I, for want of a better word, I'm a progressive. I'm politically correct. I'm all in favor of these things. Like, I've lived through great changes in the 1970s. You know, when I was growing up, TV was all racist and misogynistic and homophobic, and I hated it. You know, I'm entirely in favor of everything that you just said, entirely in favor. But Justin Sacco's tweet was not that. And if you're going to destroy somebody when they're asleep on a plane, and in fact, the fact that she was oblivious to her destruction was part of the hilarity of that night. People were fucking loving the fact. We're about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's being fired. That was one of the tweets that night. And then somebody linked to a flight tracker website so everybody could wait for her plane to land so they'd know that, you know, that's torture. That's literally torture.
It's awful. But when you've got a million people doing it, you can find the worst example. Yeah. I think most people who hit like or something were just saying she shouldn't have said that.
People were tweeting things like, I want to go home, but everybody in this bar is just obsessed with waiting for Justine Sacco to land. That's what was happening that night. That is not good. That is not social justice. That is, as somebody said in, you know, reviewing my book, that's not social justice. That's a cathartic alternative to social justice.
Yeah, and it turns over to something where people become, it becomes a show. So let's see if we can do this to this person.
So if you say, well, that's all right too, because we want to call out racism.
Of course that's not all right.
Yeah, well, thank you. Because it's kind of, it's kind of offensive
But you don't want to lump things in together. So let's not lump in the person who corrects Justine Sacco or just criticizes her, which you're certainly free to do, from the person who wants to see her fired or killed, right?
No, of course.
So the consequences, you're not destroying her by criticizing her.
A lot of people fucking kill themselves in that position. And if they don't kill themselves, they get insomnia. You know, I hope that matters to you. I hope it matters to you that people are mentally destroyed for a misconstrued liberal tweet, that they get insomnia, they get agoraphobia. I'm not talking about public figures. I'm not talking about agents provocateurs. I'm not talking about authors. I'm talking about care workers who make a joke that comes out badly and their life is destroyed. You know, that is not cool. And also, it fucks real social justice. And about real social justice, I'm in entire agreement with you.
Yeah. I've been publicly shamed for stupid things I've said. Have you?
Yeah.
Are you okay?
No, I didn't kill myself. Glad to see you didn't kill yourself. You know, you're dealing with really serious shit here. You know, kids are killing themselves. And, you know, the impact. I've met people, you know, with depression, with extreme anxiety, with insomnia. You know, this ruins people, and that's not social justice. Social justice, I'm entirely in favor of. I love the fact that we're living in a more...
How are you drawing that line so distinctly? I mean, I feel like you're casting me as somebody who doesn't care about those consequences. I'm merely saying that there's two different interests to be balanced here. That...
Yeah, so, and me too. I also feel that.
Yeah.
What's annoying me so much is that you're attacking me for something that isn't true. In the book, I draw these distinctions. I, you know, in the afterword of the paperback edition of the book, I write about all of this stuff. I write about Black Lives Matter because Black Lives Matter had become a thing by then, and I draw the distinctions. If you don't draw the distinctions, you are punishing people the same punishment for wildly differing crimes.
How do you...
And do you really want that? Do you want somebody to get fucked in exactly the same way for stealing a loaf of bread or killing someone?
No, and I think that this is a new social force. The fact that we can do this is like we have no mechanism for this.
Can I say to you that I think, given of what you just said, I think you should think harder about it. Because I don't think you're thinking hard enough about when you think that Justine Sacco's punishment was justified because of Me Too and Black Lives Matter.
Well, now you're putting words in my mouth.
Well, that was basically what you were saying to me. I mean, you know, people can sort of see whether I'm overselling that point or not.
Well, if in fact I drew an equivalency, which I don't think I did, then let me refine it now. I don't think so.
Good.
I don't think so.
Good, because I feel the same way you do. You're attacking me for something that isn't true. I'm a big supporter of social justice. I'm not a right winger. Well, I'm not one of those anti woke, you know, agent provocateur types. That's not me. I'm a progressive. I'm on the left. I'm the same as you.
Again, those are not words I would ever use to describe you.
It's just I felt that that's sort of basically where you were veering.
It's just the question that I asked from a place where I think you were very early and prescient in identifying this phenomenon. And I saw this clip of Jordan Peterson crying when he was talking about how it feels to have a bunch of people digitally outside of your door with pitchforks. And he was mocked because, of course, he's done that to other people.
Yeah, well, exactly.
But he's right.
Yeah, but also, you know, I'm not writing about, you know, in that book, I'm not writing about people like Jordan Peterson. I'm not writing about people who put themselves out there as these kind of agent provocateurs and then sort of get all upset when, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about Jordan Peterson in particular.
Problem is your talent, is that because you were early to this, because you were prescient, I think, wrote material that suggested to me, as your reader and listener, a certain disgust with the pylons, and where your sympathies lied seemed very clear to me. And my question was if that's changed as we have entered into these moments where really important social movements have been born out of the fact that people actually have a platform from which to call things.
But that's exactly what I felt at the time. And in fact, I write about that in the book. There were things that were certainly, you know, I was excited about the fact that when a columnist for the Daily Mail wrote something homophobic, and then Twitter would mobilize and get advertising pulled from the Daily Mail, and that would stop people being so homophobic in columns in the Daily Mail. I was fine with that.
There's like a system that could kind of work there.
Yeah, but then it became, you know, then as I say in the book, we got so into it, you know, we fell in love with our new power so much that our standards slipped, and so we started going for people who didn't deserve it.
Yeah.
And that is what happened.
Is it?
Yes, of course it's fucking what. Of course it's what happened.
I feel like something else has happened since. Like I look, what I was.
And social movements like Me Too, Black Lives Matter. Of course, I'm 100%. I love it. I'm massively applauding of it. It's like it's. But that's not what my book was about.
When I have stumbled and said something that triggered a response from people that got filed under a category, well, that's has implications of racism, or has implications of sexism, and I would get dragged on Twitter. Uh-huh. I had sleepless nights, anxiety. I felt terrible. And I absolutely felt a sense of defensiveness and self-pity. When I was criticized in that way, because being accused, especially for white men such as ourselves, it's like, it feels like that kind of could take all of your power away to be publicly dragged as a racist or a homophobe or something like that. Like, it really feels very threatening. And I feel like, just as you were saying earlier, I'm on your side. Why are you putting a black hat on me? And as those feelings, we're kind of moving into a place where there's a bit more familiarity with this territory, and we're learning how to deal with these things.
Well, actually, I think people have become a little bit like, you know, hospital superbugs in a way. People are, you know, and everything you just said about how you learned from your shaming, you know, that's fine. I'm not critical of that at all.
What's it been like for you when you've found yourself criticized online?
Yeah, you know, I think I feel I went through the same trajectory that you just described.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was good for you in a way.
Well, it depends whether it was fair or not.
Over time, you find the parts that are legitimate.
Yeah.
And you hope to learn from them.
Yeah. I think that's fair. But the problem is it's a little bit, you know, but I mean, if all shamings and results of shamings were as beautiful and halcyon as the way that you and I just described it, then everything would be okay. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And one thing that's happening is just look at Ralph Northam, the Virginia governor, who was caught with, you know, blackface photographs. And he said, well, I'm not quitting. Because what's happening, and obviously you see Trump doing it and you see all of Trump's people doing it, you know, get over it. You know, we're assholes, get over it. This is what we do, get over it. And this is another byproduct of our shaming culture. It's like, you know, it's like the bugs have become resistant to shaving and have turned into hospital superbugs. And that's another real-world consequence of what's happening. The Trump presidency is a consequence to some extent of all of this culture.
What's a backlash to it?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so as I say, like, you know, you and I have had that experience where we've been unfairly shamed, but we've taken the good bits and thought, okay, I get that, I'll learn from it. That's great. But, you know, not everybody's experience is like that. The people who commit suicide's experience isn't like that. And also the transgressors who then double and triple and quadruple down and then take over the world in the most heinous ways is another consequence of it. So, you know, don't be too halcyon.
No, it's an ugly and cacophonous process.
Mm-hmm. And uncomplicated. And this is why I object to, you know, some of your earlier questions, because it felt like you weren't, and maybe I'm wrong, and, you know, maybe, you know, when people listen back to this, they'll figure out if I'm right or wrong about this. And, you know, I could be wrong, but the way it felt at the time when you were saying those things was that you were taking a nuanced argument and making it a bit too black and white.
Well, I'm glad.
Which you're not doing now.
I'll have to listen to the playback to find out myself.
Because it's serious shit. I mean, you know, public shaming on social media has changed the world in very, you know, in some good and some bad ways. And so you have to not be didactic about it. It's not a subject to be didactic about.
If we have a disagreement, perhaps we don't. But I think if we did, it would come down to this. I see this as a realignment of power where we have people who never had a voice before finding a voice, and that voice actually has consequences. Hmm. I don't think that all of those consequences are great, and I'm not cheering for every outcome of that. But I think that finally, people have a seat at the table who never did before, and there is some sort of a negotiation that is taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, if I'm not mischaracterizing your position, everybody needs to calm the fuck down. Mm-hmm. And stop using that voice the same way that they've been using it, and be much more careful about the consequences of their voice, because you have no idea what that person's personal life is like or what led to that.
No, you know what I think?
So tell me if I've got you wrong there.
I know what I think is that I think the truth is both of those two things that you just said combined.
Thank you, John.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, I did a thing a couple of years ago in Australia with Naomi Klein, and a couple of people said at the time, because my book had just come out, you know, oh, I'm surprised, you know, Naomi Klein shames people all the time. You know, what are you doing sharing a bill with Naomi Klein? And I said, well, you can't have her argument without my argument, and you can't have my argument without her argument. So, you know, this conversation has reminded me a little bit of that. I'm not in disagreement with anything you said at all, not at all. And, you know, the moving way that you described about the realignment of power, I'm in total agreement with. And I also feel very happy to be living through this time of social change entirely. You know, my one truck with you is that I feel that you were portraying my views, my views, which actually are not that dissimilar to yours at all, just maybe a little bit more holistic, as being something different than what they actually are.
That was your Canada Land episode, and it's crowdfunding month, so once again, if you like what we do here, please support us at patreon.com/CanadaLand. We really do rely on your support. You can email me at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything that you send us. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com, where you'll find a new episode of Oppo, or listen to last week's episode, which is like this interview with Lisa Raitt, which is the most candid interview with a conservative politician I have ever heard. Jordan Cornish is our producer. Kasia Mihailovic is our senior producer. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. I'm going to say it one more time. If you want ad-free versions of our podcasts or keychains or t-shirts, or if you just appreciate what we do and want to be a part of it, support us at patreon.com/CanadaLand. And thank you.